All right, we're beginning here on the top of Mem Tet Amud Aleph, the new Perek. The new Perek begins a series of Mishnayot, as well as a series of Prakim, which discuss here terminology, words that are utilized by people to take Nidarim, and the question in each of the Mishnayot and then the subsequent Gemara is, what is the meaning of that word, or what does that word encompass? And therefore, each Mishnah, you're looking at a specific terminology, which seems to be a common terminology. And then you're looking at exactly what is the meaning of that word in the context or the situation at large. And if you look here in the Rambam describes in Perashat Mishnayot, Justin says to take note of this issue, which is true in general with regards to these Mishnayot, which is, he says, Vayikar, Shenigrarim Acharav, Elu Dinim, that the basic premise or the basic idea that one has to keep in mind here is the fact that we always go after Lishon B'nei Adam, what the common parlance is, what people normally use the terminology to mean. It has to do with the way that people express themselves and the meaning of the word in that social context. Shiba'oto makom shenishba'bo adam. And it has to do with the location in which the person took the shvua. Ulufi ma shimore alav ba'oto azman. And it's also time situation. And that just because it meant something in the past doesn't mean that's what it means today. Valderech mashal imaya makom shenishba'bo korim ko'oto zman mivushal litzli. If it happens to be that in the place where he took this nether or this shvua, that's subsumed under the word mivushal is also roasted or cooked, hariakol asur lav, then everything would be restricted. V'mein korim mivushal ela mivushal mamash. If they only use the word mivushal to mean mivushal, harize asur lav el mivushal levado, then he's only restricted in mivushal. V'ze maaseh hekish mikol ma sheyesh b'zoa mesechta. And that's what you need to know from this whole mesechta. B'amro hanoder Mikach asur bedavar ploni umutar beploni. Shvichozo ze amnam amru hatano lefi mikomo ulefi lishonam boto hazman. That all these mishnayot are very, very time specific and place specific, location specific. Ulefi amufusam etel hamon. And that's the way that people generally speak. Basar lanu al derech hadimyon. And therefore he, through that, said, this is what the meaning is, or this is what the encompassment of this word is. And therefore, the fikach, havein ze, v'lo nitzarech lachziro b'meshanu atidim lomar. And based on that, we won't have to go back and repeat this. But what the Rambam is basically laying out is that the Mishnayot that we're about to look at are very specific to the time of the Tana, and very specific to the place, or the location of the Tana. But that means that in other places, in other times, the outcome or the meaning of the word might be somewhat different. So then why explain it, or why go through all these Mishnayot, is because it gives you a methodology for looking at the word, a methodology for understanding how to look at these types of Nidarim and Shvuot and the usage of terminology and words. It does also enlighten us into other contexts, which I will mention today. But in general, these Mishnayot and the upcoming Mishnayot, we're going to find that the Gemara or the Mishnayot, they're defining words that are very specific to their time. And again, today it could be different, it could be the same. So just have to keep that in mind when we read the Mishnayot. It says here, anoder min ha-mivushal, someone who restricts himself from eating something that is cooked, mutar bitzli u-bishaluk. Person then is permitted to have something that is roasted and something that is shaluk. Now shaluk has different meanings. The Rishonim in different places also argue about the meaning. Over here, you can see that Rashi brings, what is shaluk is mifushal yoter midai, something that is cooked too much, meaning that it's cooked more than the normal process of cooking, beyond the normal process of cooking. On the other hand, you can look in the other Rishonim over here who mentioned that shaluk is actually something that is not mifushal kor tzorcho, something that is not cooked fully or the amount that it should be cooked. The Ran over here says that both of those interpretations are correct. It just, in context over here, it makes more sense to say that shaluk means partially cooked than fully cooked. And therefore, he leans in favor of explaining it that way in this instance, but not to say that the other meaning is not correct, just in context. Or in this Mishnah, it makes more sense to talk about shaluk. So here, a mebushal, someone takes a nether not to eat things that are cooked, they do not include roasted, does not include partially cooked, meaning that mebushal means mebushal, literally cooked. Amar konam tapshil she'eni toheim. He says about, I will not taste anything that is tapshil. Now here, instead of mebushal, which is talking about the verb, over here it's talking about the noun that is something that is tavshil, it is a cooked item. So then, asur b'masik de rarach, umotar b'aveh. That means that you are asur in things that are, we'll call it here, masik de rarach is more liquidy, things that are not as solid. The way that Rashi terms it is, something sheish barotav, something that has gravy in it, has a sauce to it. Others suggest that masik deira is something only cooked maybe in water versus other spices and other things that are added to it. Or it has to do with the consistency of the item, meaning that is this a liquidy or more viscous type of item, or a viz, something much thicker and something that is solid in nature. We'll see in the Gemara again, it'll give more definition to this. Umutar bebeitza turmuta. And you are permitted to eat this beitza turmuta, which is a heavily cooked egg. It's talking about a situation in which they cook the egg over and over and over again till it basically dehydrated in a sense and it shrunk and you were able to pop it in your mouth and eat it in one shot. But that was something that's not considered to be tafshil anymore because of the nature of the way it's cooked. Ubdala tarimutza. Or with a gourd that was placed into the coals itself. These were generally, when we're talking about these cases, it's talking about an item that is not fully ripened or not edible in its state. What they used to do is they used to bury it inside the coals and the heat of the coals used to quote unquote sweeten it or soften it up and then it was edible at that point. Again, that's not considered to be something that's called a tavshil. Hanuder mimaseik deira. Someone takes a nether from things that are made in the pot. Eno asur elo mimasei retachta. Then you're only restricted in something that is cooked. Rashi says, Devar haroteach, kigon rotev. Again, Rashi focuses on that, that it's something that is hot and that is cooked in a liquid or dissolves inside of the pot. So that would be the definition for Rashi. Others suggest that it's anything that's in a pot that is made inside of the pot. That would be asur. On the other hand, the Rambam, the Perush Mishnah note, says that it's anything that's machal, that is made through either boiling of flour or some sort of softened bread that's put into hot water. Amar koneam hayored l'kteira she'eni toim. Someone says that anything that goes into the pot, I will not taste. Asur b'chol mitvashlim b'kteira. Then you're restricted in anything that goes into a pot itself. So here you have different terminologies, whether you're using the verbs or the nouns. And the Mishnah is trying to give definition to each of these items, and the Gemara will discuss in more detail each of those items. So Tanya, Rabbi Shaya Oser, Va'afo Pishir Ein Ra'ayah L'davar, Zecha L'davar. So we have a braita in which Rabbi Shaya disagrees with our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says that when you use the term Mevushal, the verb to cook, it does not include roasted, and it does not include shaluk. He comes along and says that's not true, at least with regards to roasted. Roasted is a subset of cooking. So as opposed to the word literally to cook, which would mean to put it into something that has water and to boil it and cook it in that manner, he sees the word mevushal, which we see in other contexts, to have a much broader context of anything that is heated up and prepared. So Rabbi Shaya disagrees and says that sli is included under the word mevushal. He says, even though I don't have a proof to this, zecha de davar, I do have a mention of this, Shenemar, because it says in Divrei Yamim with regards to the Korban HaPesach, it says, Vayashlu HaPesach Ba'esh Kemishpat. They cooked the Korban HaPesach in the fire, Kemishpat, like the way it's supposed to be done. But we know what's the way that a Korban Pesach is supposed to be done. It's Liesh. It's roasted. So the fact that the Pasuk tells you Vayashlu with regards to Liesh shows you that the verb Bishul is used even when we're talking about Tzliyesh. Now over here, there are a couple of things to discuss. The first of which is that the Rabbi Kiva Eger over here says, why did Rabbi Shaya, go to the pasuk in Divrei Yamim. It's a pasuk in Parshat Re'eh. You go to Parshat Re'eh, it says, Vishalt v'achalta. With regards to the Korban of Pesach over there, it says, you will be mvashelet, and Chazal have to deal with it there. It's problematic in that pasuk as well, that they use Bishol with regards to the Korban of Pesach. Right. There it's clear that the word, when you have the pasuk that says, that you're not allowed to do it, mevushal b'mayim ki im tzliyesh, there it's clear that the word mevushal is in contrast to tzli. But we see the word mevushal is also used to encompass tzli. So where it's not delineated clearly, does the word mevushal have broader context? For instance, we see it in the Mishnayot and Shabbat, with regards to melachot of Shabbat. The Mishnah tells us that bishol is one of the 39 melachot. Then in the list of how it explains the melacha, it talks about ofeh, talks about baking. Mar itself asked the question, what do you mean? You said bishol, and now you have ofeh. So we see that the term bishol is used in both ways. It's used to mean the specific cooking in the manner of just cooking, meaning in water, but it's also used to have a broader meaning, which means anything that's prepared through heat or through fire. What we're saying here is that, yes, in the context of the Torah, say in Parshat Bo, when it contrasts bishul b'mayim versus tzliyesh, it's clear there that the word bishul is used in contrast to tzliyesh, and the two don't have the same meaning. But later on in the Torah, in Parshat Re'eh, when it uses the word bishul to describe what's done with the Korban HaPesach, it's saying that they cooked the Korban HaPesach. Does that mean that they cooked it in, boiled it in water? No. It means that the general world, bishalta v'achalta, means you prepared it. How do you prepare it? That's tzliyesh. That's what you have to say. Now, Chazal agree with you and say that the word bishul over there does not mean tzliyesh, but rather it's referring to the chagigat arbasre. It's referring to the chagiga that came with the Korban HaPesach. So that might be actually one of the answers to Rabbi Kivager's question, is that Chazal over there say that the word bishul that's used in Parshat Re'eh actually is not referencing the Korban HaPesach, but rather referencing the chagiga. The other thing you could answer is that there in Parshat Re'eh, it doesn't specifically associate the word bishul with the tzliyesh. It just says, bishalt v'achalt. Over here, in the Divrei Yamim, it says, v'yivashlu ha-pesach ba'esh, that they cooked it in the fire. So there, it makes it sound like the bishul is used specifically in the terminology of using roasting, and that's why Rabbi Shai uses that pasuk rather than that of Re'eh. The last possibility maybe is the fact that it's in the Ktuvim. So generally, by Ktuvim, we say Divrei Torah, we don't learn from Divrei Kabbalah. But over here, we're trying not to learn from Divrei Torah, we'll see in a second, but rather we're trying to learn out from Divrei Chazal, or Divrei Bnei Adam. The Ktuvim, which are the latest of the books of Tanakh, they're much closer in language to the language which is in use at that time. And therefore, if in Divrei Yamim they use the word Bishul describing Tzliyesh, then there's something to say that that might have been actually the vernacular at the time. So now the Gemara says, Lema b'hakamiflege. Let us say this is the machlok between our Tano and Rabbi Shaya. The Rabbi Shaya savar haleich achar lishon Torah. That Rabbi Shaya says the way that we define the Dorim is by the way that the Torah defines the word. We're looking for an objective standard, that which the Torah gives us. The Tana Dilan, our Tana savar bin Nedarim haleich achar lishon bin Adam. On the other hand, our Tana believes that the Dorim are determined by the vernacular, by the way that the word is used by the common folk. When it says, lo, the kuliyama binidarim aleich achar leshon bnei adam. Now, everybody agrees, and this is the sheet of the Bavli, which is that nidarim are only guided or governed by the way that people normally speak. Marki atrei, o marki atrei. And this is basically what the Rambam said in the Perush Mishnayot, but each one of them was looking at it like his city or his location. Batro de Tana Dilan, in the city of Artano, litzli, karule tzli. They called roasting, roasting. Ulmivushal, karule mivushal. And cooking, they called cooking. They were separate. They did not overlap. Bahatur Rabbi Shaya. On the other hand, in the city of Rabbi Shaya, afilu tzli, karu mivushal. The word mivushal subsumed in it, not just cooking, but any type of preparation, even including roasting. So where it says, vakra nasivla. Wait a minute, he brought a pasuk. So why are you saying this has to do with the normal usage or the vernacular if he brought a pasuk? It says, asmachta ba'alma. That's not, the pasuk he wasn't bringing as a proof, but rather as a smach, something that indicated that the usage was that way. And that's what I mentioned to you before, the fact that he brought from a ketuvim might be helpful, or that might back up the fact that their usage of the word was the proper way to use it. Well, we see that the word does have that more expanded form, and it's not an unusual usage of the word. And so, based on that, our Gemara concludes that everybody believes Halech Achar Lashon Bnei Adam. Just a question of what was the usage in each of their location. The Yerushalmi maintains the differentiation that we stated over here, which is between Lashon Torah and Lashon Bnei Adam, but the Yerushalmi continues in a different way. It says everybody believes that Lashon Bnei Adam governs, but Rabbi Shaya is Choshesh Lachomra for Lashon Torah. So he imposes on top of Lashon Bnei Adam the additional layer of Lashon Torah. As opposed to here in the Bavli, which everything is Lashon Bnei Adam, and Lashon Torah has no impact whatsoever, Yerushalmi maintains Maskana that Rabbi Shaya uses both Lashon Bnei Adam and Lashon Torah in order to guide or govern us in these cases. Now, you raised the question about Bishul Akum. In the Yerushalmi is much more expansive or extensive over here with regards to the questioning of what is subsumed under Mivushal. Now, in general, some of this seems esoteric because it all has to do with the usage of the word or the vernacular at the time. It may not have application today. One of the things that does have application is regards to Bishul Akum. When we talk about Bishul Akum, what is subsumed under Bishul Akum? Most people define that Bishul Akum has to do with the preparation of the item or making it into an edible state from a point of being inedible to the edible state. That has implications for a number of items. One of them is, for instance, the microwave. Is a microwave deemed to be Bishul Akum? So there are two approaches to this, and actually has to do with the Hashkachot in two Dunkin' Donuts. There's a Dunkin' Donuts that's found in Elizabeth, New Jersey. You go into that Dunkin' Donuts, they have a Hechsher and that Tudat Kashrut, and there's nothing mentioned on it. There is also a Dunkin' Donuts that's found in Far Rockaway. And in that Dunkin' Donuts, if you go in, there's a Tudat Kashrut. But it does mention that if you get the egg croissant, where they put the egg into the microwave and prepare it, that's probably a problem, Bishul Akum. So that difference comes up here. Is putting something into the microwave Bishul Akum or not Bishul Akum? In Elizabeth, New Jersey, Rabbi Teitz says that his father, Rabbi Pinchas Teitz, believed that Bishul Akum only applied to something that went on a fire. Bishul Akum involves a fire, and we know that from the dinim that come out of this, like the Ramah, and the way that he passes, especially for the Ashkenazim, that as long as the Jew helps out with something, even a little bit, and that's putting something into the fire, that the fire is the key aspect of it. And therefore, fire is integral to the problem of Bishul Akum. Without fire, there's no Bishul Akum. And therefore, he believes that Bishul Akum does not apply to the microwave. And that's why the Tudat Kashrut in the Dunkin' Donuts in Elizabeth does not have that exception for the Bishul Akum with regards to the microwave. In Far Rockaway, they believe that Bishul Akum applies to anything that's cooked or prepared, like Bishul. There in the microwave, it simulates what a fire would do and creates Bishul, and therefore be a sur. The other case where it comes up, which is interesting, is with regards to smoking. What happens if you smoke an item? That's what the Yerushalmi asks. What about Ishun? Is Ishun subsumed under Mivushal or not subsumed under Mivushal? That also has implications for Bishul Akum. That's because many of the fish that we get, smoked fish especially, are actually smoked right after they catch it and done out in places where there's not necessarily a mashkiach or not necessarily a Jew that's helping out with the preparation of the smoking of the fish. Is that a problem of Bishul Akum? That would be determined by whether Ishun, whether smoking is considered to be a subset of Bishul or not a subset of Yishul. This Yerushalmi becomes pivotal in that discussion. Yerushalmi actually leaves it, Bateku, does not answer the question. It doesn't know whether Ishun is a subset of Bishul or not. But it has, again, implications with regard to Bishul Akum, because if it is determined to be Bishul Akum, then smoked fish would require that there be a Jew involved in the process. If Ishun is not a subset of Bishul, then it would be, again, it would be something that you could have the Akum do, and it would not affect the fact that it's determined or considered to be Bishul Akum. So that's it. You have to really, by Bishul Akum, you have to define what Bishul is. Here, we're definitely going after Lachshon Bnei Adam. So maybe that has impact in Bishul Akum as well. Or maybe Bishul Akum has, because of the nature of the Takana, it's very focused on either specific types of things like fire or heat and other types of things that you have to use as the definition. But clearly, the Poskim, when they come to look at this, are influenced by our Gemara over here, and especially the Yerushalmi, that asks in more detail what is subsumed under Bishul. Like, for instance, Afiyah, we would still say baking. Even though baking is separate from Bishul, we would still consider baking to be a problem of Bishul Akum. So you have to look at these things in both contexts, the context of the Takana itself, as well as what our Gemara sees as a definition of Bishul, and that's why these Gemaras have broader implications sometimes than simply just understanding the meaning of the word in the time period or the location in which the Tana is speaking. All right, so now continuing in the Gemara says, Konam Tavshil. Gemara says, Vami Tavshil Nadar. The Gemara says, I don't understand. And the question is, the Gemara, what is it asking about? When we said in the Mishnah, when it uses Tavshil, the Mishnah differentiated between Kedera Rach and Kedera Aveh. Said that Kedera Rach is Asur, and Kedera Aveh is Mutar. Over here, it's not clear which of those two the Gemara is asking about, and the Rishonim line up on both sides of that. Some say that the question is about the first statement of the Mishnah, that Kedera Rach is considered to be a Tavshil. And some say that the question is about the second statement, which is that Kedera Aveh is not considered to be Tavshil. So you could see in the Tosafot, he says, V'ha'amin Tavshil Nadar, V'rach lo'avi Tavshil. The Tosafot says that something soft or liquidy is not called a Tavshil. Kevan shuhu rak kimayim ba'alma. It's just like water, it's a liquid. That's not called a Tavshil. A Tavshil has to have some sort of consistency to it. We're not talking about loose or liquidy items. So that's what Tosafot says the focus of the question is. On the other hand, If you look in the Rashi, says over here, V'hami Tavshil Nadar, the Mashma ben Rach ben Aveh, means both of them. So why are you excluding Aveh? So the Rishonim look at these being the question, whether it's focused on the fact that something liquidy is not called a Tavshil, or the other way around, that Aveh is definitely called a Tavshil. Why should it be accepted from the world of Tavshil? And others still say that the question's on both. Now the question on general, once you use the word Tavshil, why is this or not, this and yes, this not? And the question focuses on both of these items. So Amar Abaye, so now Abaye gives us more clarity as to what the Tana meant in the Mishnah. Hai Tana, komide demit achel be rifta tavshil karule. So in their day, you have to remember that bread was a staple product, but anything that you ate was also eaten with bread. So anything you talked about in a meal, the bread was the staple product, and then anything else you had with it was an accompaniment to the bread. So now the question is, can you eat something independent of bread? So that's what Abaye suggests, that the Mishnah is speaking about anything that is eaten together with bread is called a tafshil. Anything that's eaten independent of bread is not called a tafshil anymore, because in a sense it becomes a replacement for the bread, or it's in lieu of the bread in the meal. We're going to see in the Gemara in a second that you don't eat bread with bread. You only eat something that is an accompaniment to bread with bread, but not something that it itself is bread with the bread. So based on that, the difference between the Kedera Rach is that it accompanies the bread, versus the Kedera Aveh, which is something that would be eaten independent of the bread, not necessarily together with the bread. V'atanya, hanoder min ha-tavshil, someone who takes a nether from the tavshil, from an item that is cooked, asur b'chol minei tavshil. He's asur in anything that is cooked, v'asur b'tzli, u'b'shaluk, u'b'mushal. He's asur in roasted, and in shaluk, whether it means overcooked or undercooked, umevushal, and things that are cooked in general, vasur beheteriot rakot, and he's asur in these heteriot that are soft, shacholim ochlim ben pitan, that the sick people eat their bread with it. Now, the Gemara of Hatanya over here is benichuta, is supportive of Abaye's understanding of the Mishnah, because you see over here, in the final statement of that braita, that the bright is very focused on the fact that you're eating it together with bread. And therefore, the hitariot rakot are included under the word tafshil because of the fact that they are eaten together with bread. So these hitariot rakot, which are considered to be what's called kra, they're a gourd, these soft gourds that were given to the sick, but they are given to the sick to accompany their bread. And since that's the case, they're included or subsumed under this nether of Tavshil. So that's supportive of Abaye's understanding of the Tana in the Mishnah. Now the Gemara says, Ini, is that really true? Now the Gemara is not challenging Abaye's statement. The Gemara is actually challenging the Braita, the fact that sick people would eat these Hitariot Rakot. Vah, Rabbi Yirmiyah Chalash. Rabbi Yirmiyah was ill, was not well. Al Gabe Hau Asya Lesuye. So this doctor came in to cure him or to take a look at him. Chazakra, the machat bebeite, he saw that there was gourds in the house. Shavke, he left him, v'nafak, and walked out. Amar malach mavta, itle, ledain bebeite. This guy has the kiss of death in his house. Vana iol asayate? And you want me to go in and cure him? The implications of his statement are that the gourds were the malach hamavet. So you have the malach hamavet that's in the house, which are the gourds. So it's obvious from that statement of the doctor that gourds are not good for someone who's ill or someone who's sick, or they're not a healthy item. Yet you just said before that sick people eat the gourds. It says, Lokasha, ha berikiche, ha beashune. It depends on the nature of the gourds. If they are soft gourds, then they're considered to be efficacious, good for the sick. Ha beashune, if they are hard or difficult to eat, then they're considered to be not so healthy or not helpful. And so that's the difference here. The case of the Braita was talking about a soft gourd, and the case of the doctor was talking about a case of a harder gourd, or whether that means the inner sides of the gourd, which we'll see in a second. Rava ba'ur lo'amar, ha'bikra gufei, ha'bigavei dekra. One has to do with the gourd itself. One has to do with the inside of the gourd. So the inside of the gourd, which is much softer and is healthier, that's considered to be good for you. But the kra itself, the whole gourd, or the outer side of the shell of the gourd, where it's harder, that is more problematic. Dam Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda says, Luliva de kra besilka, luliva de kitna bikutcha. So Rav Yehuda says that these are good dishes to put together, these are healthy things to do, which is luliva. Luliva is used in the Gemara in different contexts. It generally means something soft or a green shoot. Here you can see Rashi talking about it a little bit. He says it has to do with the lave, the heart, the soft heart of any item. Others talk about anything that is soft. Others talk about a green shoot. But that, luliva dekra, the softer part of the gourd, basilka, if you put it together with tered, with spinach, or beets, depending what the word selik means, that's a good thing. Luliva dekitna, if you take the soft part of the flax, bekutcha, if you put it together with the kuteach, which was a Babylonian dish that mixed spoiled milk with crusty, moldy bread and salt. It was a pungent type of dip that they used. That together with the luliva dekitna are positive. But davar zeh asur lomro bifnei amaretz. And even though Rav Yehuda said this, we don't want to share this with the amei haaretz. Now, the question is why? And here the Rishonim have many different reasons. Rashi says, "Davar zeh asur lomro bifnei amaretz mishum the davar meulehu the refuah. It's something that is healthy and it's good. It's curative. Vasur lomar lahem shum davar shehenu mimenu. But you can't tell them anything that will benefit them. This is along the lines of the Gemara at the end of the third parak in Psachim, where there was a lot of tension between the Talmidei Chachamim and the Amei Haaretz, and you can see very strong words of the Chachamim neged the Amei Haaretz. And here, this would be along those same genre or thought process, which is that we don't share with the Amei Haaretz these good things or these things that are helpful. Ve'ita amre, and then Rashi brings the second interpretation, delo lichlu tuva v'lifsudu kitna. We don't want them making these into delicacies or eating a lot of this, because then it's actually going to start to ruin. The gourds is not such a big deal, but the flax is a big deal. Because if they start using this soft part of the flax in order to make it into a dish, that will actually start to make it harder to get linen. If they want to use the flax to make the linen, then they're going to actually drive the prices up of linen because of this alternate use of the kitna. And then for economic reasons, they don't want to share it with the Amei Haaretz, because then it will cause an imbalance in the market, that there'll be too much demand for it and not enough supply, and it'll drive up the prices of a basic necessity like flax or linen. That's the two possibilities that Rashi brings down. All right, so a bad feeling about the Amei Haaretz. Gemara is never very clear about why that is, but the Gemara talks about heavy tensions between the Talmidei Chachamim and Amei Haaretz. Part of it is the view that the Chachamim said that the Amei Haaretz had towards the Chachamim. So that's understandable. That's understandable why the Amei Haaretz might have felt certain dislike or maybe even disenfranchisement from the Chachamim, because the Amei Haaretz were uneducated. They were people who didn't like the fact that the Chachamim were imposing rules and other things on them, and maybe even a sense of condescending nature from the Chachamim, and the Amei Haaretz had a bad feeling. And whether that was a quid pro quo, that the Chachamim were also reflecting back that same feeling, that's a possibility that you could suggest. What I wanted to suggest, I've mentioned this before, if you take a look today, maybe in today's world, if you would take a look at the Tshuvot of Rav Moshe Feinstein, as well as Rav Soloveitchik, with regards to the conservative movement or the reform movement in the mid-1900s to the earlier 1900s, you see them taking a very, very strong stance against those movements. Today, we look at that and say, that's like so strange. Why are they taking that? Because we're in a point now where those movements are almost definitely in decline. They're not holding up because they didn't make it past a couple of generations. And now they're not really a competition for the Orthodox movement. But in the time when they spoke about it, they spoke with such strong terms. You can't even go into a conservative shul. You can't enter a reform shul because giving them any legitimacy was something that was at the time competing with Orthodoxy and the true path of Halacha and Judaism, that it was dangerous to give them any sense of legitimacy. And therefore, they spoke with very strong language against those movements. Something, again, today to us would seem like almost out of place or an anachronism because we don't understand, we don't even see that anymore. So I would suggest that maybe the same thing was going on with the Talmidei Chacham and the Amei Aretz, that the Amei Aretz, and it might even be the term that they're using for them, the Amei Aretz, were the equivalent of the conservative movement or reform movements that were saying, you know, you don't have to listen to the Chachamim, or why are they making us do all this stuff and that stuff? These were types of movements, or I would say popular movements, that tried to dilute or water down halacha or the necessity for listening to the Chachamim. And that's maybe why the Chachamim took such a strong stance against them. Again, today we look at it and we say, what was the big deal? But that's because we weren't there. But at the time, it might have been a very big battle for the legitimacy and what would be the future of Judaism. And therefore, the Chachamim took what would seem to be a much stronger stance that we could understand because of the context in which that battle was taking place. That would be my suggestion, maybe, as to why the Chachamim takes such a strong stance against the Amei Aretz. To be careful with these things, that when people try to start what they call, quote-unquote, Orthodox strains that are really leaving the halachic path, so those are the places. If people think of them as legitimate, then sometimes you'll see, and again, it happens today, that people will take a strong stance against that, which seemingly they're innocuous or they're not really so far off path. But if they're winning the hearts of the people or they're taking away the legitimacy of mainstream Orthodoxy, then sometimes you have to take a strong stance against those positions, stronger than you would have expected, given how, you know, little or how close they are to what we seem to be the mainstream and even how insignificant they might be. But that strong stance might come to draw red lines between what's considered to be legitimate and what's considered not to be legitimate. I'm not the arbiter of these things, but that might be the impetus for some of the battles or the statements of people today along those lines. Over here says that the reason that we don't tell the Amei Aretz is because shemaligim aleinu, they're going to make fun of us. V'omrim, she'anu kovim milei dechucha v'itula v'shas, that this is what's in the Gemara, this type of stuff, this mundane type of matters in the Shas. And then he says, v'kotches perish asur l'movehem shom kana. So then he quotes the other Perush of Rashi, which is that we're not allowed to teach him anything beneficial. And he says that he doesn't think that's the right interpretation. The Rosh brings something along the lines of what Tosfot says. He says, Shaligu al Dvarenu, Shadvarim Elu Afilu Anashim Yodot Otam. So as opposed to Tosfot, who says, these are just mundane matters that are thrown into the Shas, the Rosh says that this is such common knowledge that they're going to make fun of us, that we're putting this in the Gemara to teach, oh, wow, this wonderful thing. This even the women know about this. Everybody knows about this. This is not something that you have to, big chiddush, that you have to write down. So for whatever the reason is, you see the Rishonim playing with different reasons over here. The Gemara over here suggests that it should not be shared. It's not something that we publicize with regards to the Amei Aretz. Now, Rav Amar, Man Chulin, when we talk about sick people, who are we referencing? He says they're Rabbonon, referring to the Talmidei Chachamim. Rav Letamei, this is Rava Lashitato, Dama Rava. Kiman Matzlina and Al Ktsire Vamirire. Like, who is the position that we dive in every day for the Ktsire and the Mi'irire? So if you look in Rashi, Rashi says Ktsire is Rofei Chole Amo Yisrael. When we make the Bracha of Rufa'inu in Shmon Esrei, who is that following? Mirire, Rashi says, is referring to Al Pleitat Sofrehem. He's talking about the Ala Tzadikim. So those two brachot that are in Shmon Esrei, like, who are those brachot that we find in the Shmon Esrei? On the other hand, the other Rishonim, you can see it in the Ran, as well as the Tosafot, that the word Mireyeh is not clear. You already mentioned Tzirei, so what is the reference to Miriei? So Gemara says, Keman k'Rabbi Yossi. It's like the sheet of Rabbi Yossi. Now, Rabbi Yossi is a machloket that is found in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, and the Balei HaTosafot discuss it heavily over there, and over here as well, you see the Gemara dealing with it, which is the fact that there's a machloket as to when is the fate of an individual determined. The Chachamim's position is that the fate or the din of a person is determined at Rosh Hashanah. And therefore, if your fate's already determined at Rosh Hashanah, to daven refeinu every day is tefillah shav. That's what this Tosafot says over here. It's a worthless tefillah. There's no point in doing that. The fate or the person's din for that year was already determined at Rosh Hashanah. So davening on a daily basis is meaningless because you're not going to make a difference at this point. The difference was made before Rosh Hashanah. Once you pass Rosh Hashanah, you can't make any difference. That's the sheet of the Chachamim. Rabbi Yossi, on the other hand, says that everybody has a din every day. And so now the Gemara says, like who do we daven every day and say Refaino? That's like Rabbi Yossi, who says we can still make a difference in our din every day. So it's an amazing statement of the Gemara over here, because the Gemara is suggesting that to daven every day would be meaningless because of the fate determined at Rosh Hashanah, and that's the sheet of the Chachamim. Rabbi Yossi is the dat yachid, and therefore, davening every day is like a dat yachid because you can't even make any impact. So Tosafot in Rosh Hashanah tries to soften the blow. Tosafot in other places tries to soften the blow and says that maybe even according to the Chachamim, you can make a difference. That Rosh Hashanah determines the general fate of an individual and that it's very hard to change it. To change that gzar din is almost impossible. But maybe in extenuating circumstances or unusual things that you can actually make a difference. Maybe Tefillat Rabim. There are different ways maybe we can impact on it. And that maybe even according to the Chachamim, it's possible that it's not a tefillat shav, that you could daven every day and make a difference. But that brings it to the broader question. And again, this is not the place to discuss it, but at least to raise the issue of, then it seems like almost unnecessary to daven every day because there's nothing that you can do anymore. All the determinations, all the decisions were made. So that might also have to do with the nature of tefillah. But maybe sometimes tefillah is not only about supplicating before God, but many times tefillah, and that's why the verb tefillah is used in the reflexive form, the hitpalel, is more about the individual, about us understanding our relationship with God, and everything that happens to us is coming from God. Less about our asking and our supplicating before God, but more about our reflecting on that and understanding, therefore, our position and what's happening to us in the world. And therefore, the tefillah is as important for the individual as davening and for the actual things that they are asking for. And so that might also be a reason to daven, even though, again, maybe it doesn't have as much impact as we would like because there's so much determined beforehand from the time of Rosh Hashanah. So now, what the Rishonim say over here, based on the Gemara now, is Midav Amar Ktzirei Umrirei. Since it uses both terms over here, Shmamina Ktzirei Ktzirei Mamash. Tzirei means sick people, and that's really sick people. Miriei, who are these Miriei then? That must be the Rabbonon. The fact that he uses two nouns to describe these people, the Tzirei, we understand, those are sick people, and that's why you're diving for them to be well. Who are these Miriei? So as Rashi said, he says it's referring to Alat Tzadikim. The other Rishonim say it more along the lines that they're really sick, and that's who's being asked for in Rofei Cholim, is also the Chachamim. And that's Rava Letame that says that the Chachamim are weak from their dedicating themselves to Limud HaTorah, from dedicating themselves from going over their girsa, so they are not strong, well, or healthy, and therefore they need to have tefillot, not only just for the cholim who are really sick, but these individuals who are weaker or have less strength to them because of their dedication to Torah. And now the Gemara continues, Umutar be'aveh. Our Mishnah says that you're allowed to eat the aveh, because now, based on the way that we've described the Tan over here, aveh does not accompany the pot. That does not accompany bread. The Gemara says, Matnita deloke bavalai. Our Mishnah is not like the Babylonians. It makes sense. Our Mishnah, the Mishnayot in general, are talking about Eretz Yisrael. All the Tanaim are found in Eretz Yisrael. And many times the Gemara is trying to reconcile what's going on in Eretz Yisrael with Bavel. And that's why the Gemara asks, what does this language mean? Or what does this word mean? Because the Tanaim are speaking about the Lashon in Eretz Yisrael, or are speaking about a context of Eretz Yisrael. The Gemara says the same thing over here. That the context of our Mishnah is Eretz Yisrael, because in Bavel, that's not true. Damar Rabbi Zera, Bavlai Tipshai. These foolish Babylonians, Dachle Lachma Balachma, they eat bread together with bread. Meaning that they use, and Tavshil Aveh, these thick porridges or these thick cooked items to accompany their bread. Now, based on our Mishnah, you see that a davar aveh is in lieu of bread. You don't eat it together with bread, but rather in lieu of bread. But the Babylonians don't do that. The Babylonians eat it together with their bread. So he says, these silly Babylonians, they eat bread together with bread. Why would you put bread on top of bread? You put something that accompanies the bread, not something that is bread. Some Rav Chista, the Mashal Ahon, Lahalei Nakdani, Duhutzal. People who can't go ahead and ask should ask these Nakdani Duhutzal. Now, Nakdani, you'll see here in the Rishonim, there are a number of definitions or meanings that are given to them. Rashi says, Nakdani are Dayakanim Bemachal. They're very particular about their food. He brings a second, the girsa, which is vit garse nakrane, l'shon karan or panav, that his face was a light, that it was shining, mleim chuchma umira pineim. These very wise individuals that causes their face to be radiant. That's two possibilities as to Rashi, what he says this word, nakdani, means. You look in the Tosafot defines nakdani over here as being individuals that are yesh mefarshim nikiyei adat, people who are sound mind or of a clear mind. That's one possibility which he brings. And the second one, he brings nakdani, which are megdakdakim midvarim, people that are very careful about things. And the Rosh over here brings an alternate explanation of nakdani, which is from the word to clean, which is again nakrani, tutsal, nikiyei adat, similar to Tosafot, but here it says, I'm a nakir chatzero, someone who cleans out or makes his chatzer tidy. Niki adat, people are very tidy or particular again. The idea being that these people are somehow experts in the etiquette or food etiquette or the nature efficaciousness of eating certain types of foods. So if Rav Chisda says, you should ask them that hadei daisa, heichen male lemechle. This daisa, which is this thicker porridge, what is the proper way to eat it? Dechite belachma dechite. Rav Chisda is a Babylonian. And so Rav Chisda is a Babylonian, eats a tavshil aveh together with his bread. But he now wants to know what's the proper way to eat, quote unquote, your bread with your bread. Should it be that you eat the porridge or the tavshil aveh of chitim together with bread made out of chitim? Udisare belachma desare, and the porridge or the thick dish that is made from barley should be eaten together with barley bread. Odilma dechite bedesare, or maybe even for the Babylonians there is some distinction or contrast that needs to be there. That means that if the porridge or the dish is made out of wheat, that the bread should be made out of barley. Udisare bedechite, and if the porridge or the tavshil aveh is made out of barley, that the bread should be made out of wheat. So that was his question, that even within Bavel, how much lechem belechem is it called? Is it lechem belechem, I mean literally you have wheat together with wheat and barley together with barley? Or even in Bavel, there's some distinction that it's wheat with barley and barley with wheat. Rova achle bechasise. Rova used to eat it together with the chasise. Over here, Rashi brings down that these chasise are kamach avshuna, which is they are made out of kernels of barley that have not ripened more than a third. They used to dry them out in the oven, and they are shelled. And then they used to mill them into a flour. So that's what he used to eat together with his dish, together with his tavshil aveh. He used to accompany it with this chasise. Tosafot brings something of a similar. He brings chasise. Kemach shel klayot v'chein perush ri. Rabbeinu Chananel. Perush kemach shel adashim. Uperusho nireh yoter. And his explanation makes a lot more sense. And again, the Ran supports that position of Rashi and the Ri, that we're talking about roasted kernels that were milled. On the other hand, we have the Rabbeinu Tam, who thinks that it's kemach shel adashim. And Tosafot seems to favor that interpretation that we're talking about lentils, and he brings reasons why he thinks that Rashi's interpretation is incorrect over here. Rabba Ravuna, Ashkechei the Ravuna, the Ka'achal Daisa, Betz Bate. He found that Ravuna was eating his Daisa, his porridge, or his thick tabshil with his fingers. Now remember, this is before the advent of cutlery. So when you ate, you didn't have many choices about how to eat. You had to eat either with your fingers, which was the most likely scenario, or you had to use some other item to dip or put into it to eat it, or you had to have some sort of rudimentary type of utensil. I mean, obviously not cutlery, but some sort of rudimentary utensil. So here he's eating this dice with his fingers. Amalei, amayka achomar biyodei. Why are you eating with your hands? Amalei, achi amar Rav. This is what Rav says. Daisa be'etzbato basim. That when you eat daisa with your fingers, it's very tasty. That's the best way to eat it. Bechol dechein betartin. And certainly with two fingers. Bechol dechein betlat. And certainly with three fingers, it's even better. So he thought that was the proper way or the best way to eat the daisa. And now we're going to see why that might not have been the case or what the nature of the question is, which is, Amar le Rav, v'chia brei. Rav said to his chia's son, v'chein amar le Rav Huna, the Rav brei. And Rav Huna said the same thing to Rav, his son. Mezamne lecha lemeichal daisa. If someone invites you to come and eat daisa, ad parsa. Go for a parsa. Lemeichal bisra, the Torah. He's inviting you to eat the meat of an ox or the meat of a nice cow. Atlata parson. You should go for three parsot. Rashi brings here two possibilities as to the interpretation. The first interpretation is that if you eat daisa, it will satisfy you for up to a parsa. You eat the meat, it will satisfy you up to three parsot. Then he brings the second interpretation, which most of the Rishonim agree with. The second interpretation, which is that if someone invites you to daisa, it's worth walking a parsa to go there for the invitation. Someone invites you to eat the basar Torah, to eat that, the meat of the ox, or some good meat, it's worth walking three parsaot to take up that invitation. Amalei Rav the Chia Brei, v'chein amalei Rav Huna the Rabba Brei, komidam lo tiflot kamei Rabcha. Devar, you should never spit out anything in front of your Rebbe, with the exception of minakra v'daisa, except for gourd and the daisa, which is like this thick porridge. Shein domim liptilto shel avar. They are similar to like a string of lead. V'afilu kamei shavur malka plot. Even in front of the Persian king, Shavur Malka, I would suggest that you spit it out. So over here we're talking about the saliva or the after saliva that comes from eating these items. So generally what he says is if you have this buildup of saliva or whatever residual in your mouth from eating dishes, just swallow it. Take it down. On the other hand, if it's something that came or this saliva that's created because of your eating of daisa or kraw, then you should spit it out, because that saliva or spittle is unhealthy. We've seen this other places in the Gemara. We had an incident where the Gemara talks about it, the woman who the man was teasing her by cutting something up in front of her, and she would swallow that spittle or saliva that she had and made her very sick, and then he made her promise that she would marry him if he cured her. So the Gemara talks about this idea that swallowing the saliva that's created through certain circumstances is actually problematic or makes a person ill. So here, he's suggesting that these two items are either not digestible if you swallow them afterwards, or there's something untoward to swallowing them, and therefore you're permitted to spit it out, even though that would be considered to be not so polite. But in these contexts, where it comes to the danger or something that's going to make you ill, then we give you permission to spit them out. So he says that with regards to the daisa and the kraw and the gourds. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda. We have a story about these two Tanaim. Chadachil daisa beetzbate. One of them was eating daisa with his fingers. Chadachil behutza. And the other one was eating it with a reed. So a rudimentary type of fork or piece of cutlery. Amalei dachal behutza delachil beetzbate. The one who was using the reed or the utensil says the guy eating with his fingers, Amatayata machilani tzoatcha. How long are you going to give me your refuse or your dirty stuff? You're sticking your fingers into my pot, into the daisa, and now I got to eat after you stuck your fingers in there. So that's what his complaint was, that this guy is sticking his dirty hands into the dish. And therefore, he wants to know, how long is this going to go on? Then I have to watch you ruin my dish by you sticking your fingers in there. So the response of that individual was, the one eating with his fingers says to the achil behutza, the one who's eating with the utensil, matay ata machilani rokha, you're double dipping. So how long are you going to now have your spittle, your saliva stuck inside of my daisa? So this is a problem that still exists today, which is that if you have a common dish, something that's shared by everybody, we'll call it the public dish, then how do private individuals deal with that public dish? So today, what we do is we usually have a serving utensil. The serving utensil was independent. You take that, you serve it onto your private plate. And once you have it on your private plate, you can eat it as much as you want, do what you want, because then you're not affecting the public dish. But in their day, where they ate out of the public dish itself, now you run yourself into a problem. You have two choices. You can use cutlery or some sort of rudimentary cutlery. But if you're doing that, every time you stick the reed into your mouth, your saliva is not on that. And when you go dip again, you're double dipping into the public dish. You're returning your saliva right back into the dish. So that was the complaint of the guy eating with his hands. And what you have to say, the Rosh mentions this over here. It says, with regards to the guy who ate with his fingers, that he wiped them on a napkin in between. He did something to wipe off the saliva, so that wasn't an issue for him. On the other hand, the problem for the guy eating with his fingers, forgetting about the saliva, say that he cleared that up, he wiped it off, whatever he did, is the dirt that's between the nails and the fingers. That's what they say over there. Even if he washed his hands, there's still stuff that's stuck in his nails or stuck on part of his fingers that's there. So every time he dips into the public dish, he's introducing that dirt into the public dish. So each one of them was challenging the other's method for eating because they were affecting the other party. And that might go back to what we were saying earlier about this idea that Rav suggested that the best way to eat daiso is with your fingers. As opposed to what? What you see here is maybe as opposed to using some sort of cutlery or dish, because you have to, again, you have to measure the trade-off here between people using their fingers and people using a utensil, which one is worse in terms of them dipping it back into the public dish again. Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, Aitu the Kamayu Bluspin, or the other gear says Blufsin. So this type of item that was brought before them, the Rishonim over here say that they are Te'enim Ra'im. They were bad figs. Rashi over here says that they were overripened figs. But whatever the problem is, these aren't things that normally are digested easily because they are not the best quality of fruit. So now it was brought before both of them. Rabbi Yehuda achal, Rabbi Yehuda partook of it. Rabbi Shimon lo achal, Rabbi Shimon refused to eat it. Amalei Rabbi Yehuda, my time alo achil mar. He says to Rabbi Shimon, why aren't you eating? I got some food here. So Amalei Rabbi Shimon, elu en yotzim ibnei mayim, kol ikar. Since this stuff is not digestible, it gets stuck in your stomach and it doesn't exit. It's there permanently. So Amalei Rabbi Yehuda, so Rabbi Yehuda being the optimist says, kol shekein, shenis machalim na machar. Wonderful. If it sticks around that long, then it'll keep us satisfied for many days. If it never exits, it's in your stomach for so long, then eat it today, it's going to keep us going tomorrow. I mean that if the object isn't digested easily or takes time to digest, that means that it will provide satisfaction over multiple days rather than just a single day. Rabbi Yehuda Yotiv Kameh the Rabbi Tarfon. Yehuda was sitting before Rabbi Tarfon. Amalei Rabbi Tarfon, Hayom Panecha Tzuvim. Today your face is so radiant. Amalei Emesh Yatsu Avadecha L'Sadeh. Rabbi Yehuda explains, yesterday we went out to the field. Reviu Lanu Tradin. And they brought us from the fields, again, tered, over here, it's probably beets and not spinach, like it means in the modern Hebrew. V'achalnum b'lo melach, and we ate it without salt. V'machalnum b'melach, had we eaten it with salt, kon she'ekein she'yu panenu tzuvim, then we would be even more radiant. So he's describing that the food, or what they partook of, was obviously a delicacy of some sort. And the fact that they were treated to such a delicacy made him radiant, or made him all excited the next day. So now, based on this, this parlays into another story, which is some of the famous stories about Rabbi Yehuda. So Amra Hai Mochunita, the Rabbi Yehuda. So this was this matron that spoke to Rabbi Yehuda. More Viravi? How could it be that you are a teacher, a paskiner of Aloha, and you're a drunkard? Amra Hemnuta Biyodo the Hai Itita. Once he goes, you can trust me, or by the trust of this woman. If I ever had alcohol, except for Kiddush and Avdallah, and the four kosot on Pesach. So he says the only alcohol that he consumed all year round was Kiddush, Avdallah, and the four kosot on Pesach. And he says the four kosot on Pesach left him in such a bad state. He says I should have to wrap my head around my temples because of the headaches that were caused to me from drinking the wine on Pesach, from Pesach until Atzeret, until Shavuot, and that it left him in a bad state from drinking the wine for the four kosot on Pesach. So he's telling this woman, listen to me, I don't drink alcohol, and even when I do drink alcohol, it leaves me in a bad state. So therefore, I don't drink alcohol when it's necessary for the mitzvot. What's the mitzvah? Kiddush, Havdalah, and the four kosot in Pesach. This does have impact with regards to the halacha, with regards to the four kosot in Pesach. It seems over here, even if a person is not enjoying the four kosot in Pesach, or even if they don't usually drink alcohol or leaves them in a bad state, that one still has to drink alcohol for the four kosot in Pesach. And not drinking alcohol is not really an option. So some of the poskim that believe that one has to consume alcohol for the arba kosot, that this is the proof to that. That it doesn't really matter if you don't like it. It doesn't really matter if it's going to leave you in a bad state. There are many of the other poskim that believe that that's not the case, and that grape juice will suffice, and you don't need mida de mishaker for the arba kosot. But this is one of the main gemarot that plays into that machloket as to whether you must have alcohol for the four kosot. Hela, he says, well, let me explain to you, why do I look so good, or why do I look so radiant? Is chokhmat adam ta'ir panav. The wisdom of an individual gives radiance to his face. So he says, what you're seeing in me is not the face of a drunkard, that red nose and that radiant face is not coming from the fact that I'm drunk, but rather from the fact that maybe I am drunk, but drunk on knowledge and wisdom. And therefore, my wisdom is what enlightens my face. Amarle ha'utztuki, the Rebbe Yehuda, panecha domdim, ikim alvei ribit, ikim agadlei chazirin. So here it's stuki is not necessarily the classic sense of stuki. Here it seems to be a non-Jew or somebody who was challenging Rabbi Yehuda. Comes along and says, your face looks like the face of someone who lends with interest or someone who brings up pigs. Both of these were extremely profitable professions. And you look like someone who's enjoying life because you have such a good source of income. Again, not sources of income that were considered to be proper or nice ways of making income, but nevertheless, people who made income in this manner were very happy. Amalebi Udai, Tarvayu Asirin. Says, let me tell you, neither of those are permissible to a Jew. El Asirin va'arba'a beta kiseit li min beta ad be midrusha. There are 24 bathrooms from my house until the Beit Midrash. B'choshav sha'a, anich nichnas l'chol echad ve'echad. And on my way to the Beit Midrash, I make a pit stop in each one of them on the way there. So now you can see that Rabbi Yehuda is saying that this is another reason as to his tremendous radiance or his good looks is that he took care of his health. Now remember, in their day, bathrooms were not readily available. There wasn't just a running water or bathroom inside the house. If you wanted to go to the bathroom, you had to run out to the field. So people probably were wont to hold things in and to wait and so on and so forth. So Rabbi Yehuda says, I used to make sure on my way to the Beit Midrash in the morning, I made sure to take care of myself and to relieve myself on the way there so I never had to put myself in a difficult position. And that's what makes me look so healthy and so good. Rabbi Yehuda kad azil the Beit Midrash. When Rabbi Yehuda used to go to the Beit Midrash, shakal gufal katfei. He used to take a pitcher or some sort of bucket on his shoulder. Amar gdola melacha shemechabedet et balea. Great is work, which because it brings honor to its owners. So over here, he didn't think it was beneath his dignity to take this item to the Beit Midrash or to carry it to be sochevet on his own. Because when he got to the Beit Midrash, then he was able to put this barrel pitcher down and sit on it. So he didn't have to sit on the floor. He didn't have to sit on the karka. So the fact that he expended that effort to go to the Beit Midrash and carry this item there, in the end, he was rewarded with the fact that he didn't have to sit on the ground. And so he's saying sometimes it's worth the extra effort or the extra work in order to be the beneficiary of that work. Rabbi Shimon Shakil Tzana Al Katfei. Rabbi Shimon used to do the same thing, take a basket on his shoulder. So again, a similar story with Rabbi Shimon carrying a basket to the Beit Midrash for the same reason. He would turn the basket over and sit on it. So again, by carrying this item and by hauling this item, even though it was work or maybe even beneath his dignity because these were people of stature, nevertheless, if they did take it, then they benefited themselves in the end because if they worked a little bit, they got the benefit of being able to sit on it and not having to sit on the ground when they got to the Beit Midrash. The bitu de Rabbi Yehuda nafakt. She went out nakat imra. She went out and purchased wool. Avda glima dudvai. She made this cloak of wool, but it was something that was a little fancy, somewhat nice, as Rashi says. And the Ran says a glima chashuva. It was a significant type of cloak or overcoat. So kat nafakt l'shuka mechsayebe. When she used to go out shopping, she used to wear it. Again, gave herself a feeling or a sense of honor or a sense of being someone who was normal. And therefore, she wore it. When Rabbi Yehuda used to go out to daven, Havamikseh umatzleh. He used to wear the same cloak and daven with it. Whether that was because it was beloved to him, because his wife had made it, or because he wanted to wear something significant for davening. And so he took out this me'il, which was something special for davening. But what we see here is that they were very poor, and they could only afford one of these cloaks or overcloaks. So both of them used it. Both his wife and he utilized the same cloak. So they have a kad mikseh bay, and when he used to wear it, have a mevarich. He used to make the brocha, Baruch Shatani Mi'il. Baruch Hashem that wrapped me up in this cloak or in this jacket. Now again, Mi'il is something very special and unique. And this jacket, even though it was his wife's jacket, and even though it wasn't as significant as a Mi'il, nevertheless, he termed it as a Mi'il because in his own eyes, that's how he felt about it. Right? So obviously, it's not something that was clearly for a man or a woman, and therefore you don't have a problem with either Begadish or Begadisha. That's what you have to say over here. There's certain things that we call them unisex type of clothing, where it's not clearly a woman's clothing or a man's clothing, and therefore being worn by both of them was not problematic. So now, Zimna Chado, there was an instance, the Gozer Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Tanito. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel declared a fasting. Rabbi Yehuda lo ata lebeit Tanito. Rabbi Yehuda did not come to the gathering for the fast day. Amrim lei lo itle kisuya. So they explained that he didn't have anything to wear. He didn't have a jacket, he didn't have a cloak, he didn't have something to wear, so he felt uncomfortable coming to the fast day. Now whether he didn't hear about it, and therefore his wife went out with the cloak and he didn't have it available, or whether it just in general, he didn't have the means by which to come and be in a place that involved the public, and therefore he felt uncomfortable going there. So shadar leglima. So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel seemingly sends to the house of Rabbi Yehuda a cloak or a jacket for him to wear. Velo kabil, and he would refuse to accept it. Dalit sifta, he picked up the doormat, or he picked up a reed mat that was on the floor. And he says to the person sent by Rav Shimon Gamliel, Chazi Ma'iko, says, took a look, do you see what's here? But that's me, I don't want to get benefit from this world. So here you can see in Rashi, as well as in the Ran, and the other Rishonim over here, it was Ma'senisim. When he picked up the mat was on the floor, there was piles of golden coins under the mat. So he's showing the shliach, look, I'm rich. So why do I dress like this? Why don't I have a cloak? Because I don't like getting benefit from this world. I don't like spending on myself. I want to save the money. I don't want to use it for myself or to spend it on fancy things. Now, obviously, that wasn't the truth. He was just embarrassed. But in order to avoid the embarrassment, he pretended like he had the means by which to live. He had the means by which to possess what he needed, and therefore he was refusing to accept the glima. He refused to accept that gift that was given or the cloak that was brought by Rav Shimon Gamliel. That could be for two reasons. It could be from Sone Matanot Yichye, that a person who despises gifts will live, and he felt that he didn't want to accept the gift at all. Or he was embarrassed by the fact that he didn't have, and so he didn't want to accept it because that would indicate that he really didn't have. Or he also possibly over here didn't want to make a big deal out of it. He didn't want to have that stature or that standing, and he felt comfortable what he was, and he didn't want to have them impose on him that he had to take the glima and then come to the shul to participate. So for any of those reasons, he refused to take it, and when he picked up the mat, he made it seem to the shliach that he was wealthy, and that it was by choice that he didn't have a glima, and therefore he didn't need the glima that this individual had brought. Okay, we're going to stop here at the third line down on the top of Nun Amud Aleph, and we'll continue with stories of the Chachamim, their poverty, and so on and so forth, with the famous story of Rabbi Akiva and his wife, which is found here. We've seen parts of that story in Ketubot and Yevamot, and here is another piece to that famous story of Rabbi Akiva and his wife.